Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning.
So this is a thrill for year two to announce this. It shouldn't be a thrill because I watched this person just crush my hopes and dreams as a Royals fan many times, but if he wasn't such a darn nice guy, I would probably not be so nice up here. So Bernie grew up in Puerto Rico and discovered his love for baseball. At the age of 17, he was signed to a contract with the New York Yankees. He spent 16 years with the Yankees, has 4 World Series rings, countless gold gloves, and more. But most importantly for us today, he has a bachelor's in music from the Manhattan School of Music in New York. He spent 10 years working with NAMM, going to the fly-in in D.C., being an advocate for music education, and he serves on the NAMM Foundation board. So we're very excited to have our also CEO, Joe LeMond, who's an incredible interviewer, and those of you who were here for the best last year saw him talk to Mark, and it was just riveting. So I know we're in for another big treat today. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Joe LeMond and Bernie Williams.
All right, so I didn't really have a lot of things prepared to play solo, but I figure the way that I would approach this is I'm just gonna practice here and jam a little bit while you guys eat. You know, you guys be good with that? All right, cool. Thank you so much.
Hello, Bernie.
Hello.
Long time no see, man. Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
These are all our friends, Bernie. These are the, when we're lobbying in D.C., these are the people we're working for. I would just like to start by, you know, just thanking everyone here for allowing us the opportunity to be with them today, right? We're kind of all on our journey together, our musical journey, our working journey. We've got families here, some multi-generational families, and we're all trying to just do a little better every day. You know, that's the journey we're on. And my end zone, I always have to have an end zone for these sessions. My end zone today is that we just think about how each and every one of us in our own way, whether it's with our businesses and our teams or our communities, we can just be a little better. So I was gonna run it through a couple of key words that I'll keep coming back to. Character, passion, and habits, which I think will fit nicely with our kind of the road we're going to take in the next 35 or 40 minutes. But I want to say before I start, there's one person that I pulled up to the NASMD counter this year and noticed how heavy my heart felt because, Madeline, your dad's not here. And I just want to dedicate the session to Ray. Madeline, this is for Ray. And thank you. So with that in mind, the character, passion, habits, I mean, I think we can all admit we could not only personally all use a little more of that, our country could probably use a little more of that these days, and the idea that that shapes who we are. And you were shaped from an early age by a great family situation and some of those things that were, you know, you learned in your environment, your parents, your brothers, your schoolmates. So I want to talk a little bit about your journey going into first music and then sports. And it's funny, we've had these conversations. We're generally in some congressman or senator's office trying to get a bill passed or some funding.
That's true. Yeah.
And in this case, we're having the conversation about how do we help everyone be a little better in what they do in their business and in their life. So your story was really interesting when you tell the early days in Puerto Rico. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, my story, I mean, it's kind of unique in the sense that where I grew up, my mom was kind of like the one person that took the responsibility, the financial responsibility, and you know, all the major decisions, because she was the educator. She spent 40 years in the public education system in Puerto Rico. My dad had the sort of the street smarts. He was one guy that, you know, he was a merchant marine. He traveled all over the world. Whatever brought them together, you know, it was God or, you know. He was awesome because they complemented each other. Whatever my mom lacked, she was kind of rigid and very authoritative. My dad was kind of like a, you know, loose and, you know, he was wild. And when, you know, he was too out of control, my mom was the one, you know, there putting the, you know, putting the stop to the situation. So that, in that combination, you know, of characters, I grew up with my brother. And when we were about 7, 8 years old, my mom went to my dad and she said, "These kids are watching too much television. They should go out there and start doing exercises and play organized sports and be involved in music and arts." And my dad said, "Well, they might be too young for that." I said, "No, they're not too young. We're gonna do it." And that's how I started. I started playing baseball at 8 years old. At the time, my mom was a principal of a school, and one of the teachers of that school said, "I'm gonna make a little league team, and I'm gonna put your two sons to play." And that's how it started. 8 years old, I had no idea. And at 8 years old, you were really far behind in the game in Puerto Rico because these kids start playing. By the time they're 3 and 4, you see them with diapers, you know, with that little T-ball. Like, run, they start running the third
stage
base.
Moms.
So by the time they're 8 years old, they're pretty advanced. So I was starting to learn how to play the game at 8 years old, so I really felt
behind in the game. But my dad took me and my brother every day to the field. It was a field that was there after school every day, and he took us there. He made us run. He made us catch the ball, throw the ball, hit the ball. You know, I was, you know, sort of immersed into that thing. But what he was doing was basically teaching me some really, really important life lessons. And there were consistency, you know, the effort, putting 100% all the time. He would I mean, it was fun for us because we had a great time doing it. But if we were like complaining of being tired or not really wanting to do it, then he was like, no, you committed to do this, so you're gonna stay in it and you're gonna do the best that you can. And if I see that, you know, maybe it's just conflicting with your classes or your academics, maybe we can just make some adjustments. Yeah. But in their mind, it was just teaching us in a fun way how to be responsible and how to put a good effort, you know, our best effort forward. Yeah. The great thing that it was to, you know, in a game, get a base hit, and looking at my dad and pointing out to him and say, yeah, we did it together. Yeah. And, you know, that sort of experience of the rewards of the effort that you put in, you know, also were really important at that time as well. And the same thing with music. I started taking lessons at 8 years old with my professor, you know, neighborhood professor or teacher, you know, I guess. And, you know, I spent there about a year, you know, sort of, you know, having fun with it. And by the time I was in ninth grade, I had the opportunity to go to this performing arts high school. I spent 4 years there. And I was playing baseball on the side because, you know, in my mind's...
On the side,
yeah. In my mind's, in my mom's eyes, they were both means to an end. You guys are going to be educated and you're going to be well-rounded. And the way that we can do this is by exposing you guys to art, music, and sports. And in her mind, we were going to go on to be doctors, lawyers, and, you know, every mom's dream. Yeah. I ended up just being a baseball player. But, yeah, I mean, that was a great, great experience, and I was very blessed to have parents like, you know, like the ones that I had.
Resilience and determination.
Yes.
Those are the two things that I've heard you say that you learned through all of that and that have served you well through your whole life. And
yes.
Everyone, resilience and determination.
Yeah, especially when the times are bad and you don't really feel like doing it. That was the whole thing about, you know, just dispel this myth. I don't really feel like doing it. No, you committed to this. Yeah. That's not an excuse. Not, you know, what does that mean? What does that really mean? So let's go and put an effort into this. And he taught me a lot.
I've heard you tell this one story, and I think it would definitely not have been predicted that you would end up where you ended up in baseball. But about the first game when you were not really knowing what to do, called in to hit, you just went up to bat and hit. And then everyone just like walked off the field and went home, and you're like, what happened?
Yeah, that was my first organized baseball experience. I was playing I just sort of showed up. My mom just made us, you know, dress up and go into, it was a police athletic league. And we were actually in the police headquarters. They had a backyard and they had this mini game. Must've been like 7 years old. And that two teams, and I was, you know, didn't know how to play the game, so I was kind of like distracting myself, you know, playing with the aunts and the stones, and all of a sudden they've run out of players, and this is the last play of the game, bases are loaded, and I'm the only one sitting on the bench just kind of like looking everywhere. The police officer says, Bernie, come here, grab a bat, it's your turn to hit. So I grab the bat, I see the guy, you know, with the ball looking at me kind of mean, and I was like, well, I didn't do anything to you, so I'm like hitting. The guy throws the pitch, right? And I hit the ball, line drive right through his legs. I run out to first base, and everybody starts walking off the field. It was like, what happened? I mean, I just started playing. I mean, this is actually kind of fun. What's happening? The police officer goes about and tells me, well, it was the end of the game. The game was on the line, and you, my friend, hit the winning game base hit. And I was like, really? What is that? So that was my introduction to baseball. And after that point, my parents were like, well, he might have a future on this. So let's see how far he can take this.
You ruined the whole thing.
I ruined the whole thing. It was funny.
Yeah, so then baseball. Let's pick that up for a little bit. So pretty young to be all of a sudden thrust into that life. How did that happen?
Yeah, I was very young. Like I said before, I went to this performing arts high school for 4 years. And in that time, I was playing baseball in the Little League programs. When I was a junior in high school, there was this scout, talent searcher. He went to the field to see me play, but he was actually not looking for me. He was looking for the guy that was playing right field. I don't know if you guys remember the name Juan Gonzalez. He was an MVP player for the Texas Rangers. He had a stellar career, and he was playing right field next to me. And everybody, all the scouts, everybody was looking at that guy. For whatever reason, the scout for the Yankees saw him, and he saw him distracted, kind of flirting with the ladies, you know, and the fans, dancing to salsa music between innings, not really very focused on. And I had my game face on in center field. There was an incident that a ball was hit over my head, and I went over to get it, and there was a basketball court that was made in concrete, so I'm running in my metal cleats. I slide back, I fell my rear end, grab the ball and throw it, and I, you know, sort of stopped the guy from making an inside the park or home run. And from that point on, this scout said, well, I'm not looking at Juan Gonzalez anymore. I am shifting my focus to this kid, this little skinny kid named Bernie Williams. So from that point on, he started courting, you know, me and my family, saying, you know, times have changed, you know, your son has an opportunity to play baseball on the professional, you know, matter with the Yankees. There was two things. You know, my two uncles played amateur baseball. One of them played professional baseball, and the one that played professional baseball did not have a good experience playing in the minor leagues here. He was a different time, a different place. He was in the middle of the South, and he experienced a lot of trouble there. So when he came to Puerto Rico, he was one of my advisors, you know. And I said, Uncle Hedon, how was your experience as a minor league player? He said, do not go there. It's terrible. Do not go there. But he was in the 50s. You know, the scout sort of, you know, assured my mom that times were a lot different. You know, I ended up signing to play in the minor leagues at 17. Mm. I was in my junior year in high school. And my mom said, well, you at least got to have to finish your high school first before you go into this. So the year after, I finished my senior year, and then I started playing in the minor leagues right away after my senior year out of high school in Sarasota, Florida. That was my first team.
Wow. You know, thinking about baseball and in business, again, there's a lot of connection here, obviously. The role of coaching. You had coaches and people that walked you, batting coaches, or not to mention the whole team coach, but what were the roles of those people? You know, for all of us, we need people in our lives to help us develop more skill, perfect our strengths and overcome our weaknesses. But let's talk about coaches for a second and all the people that you were able to work with up the ranks. Any stories or memories you have about
coaches?
Yeah,
coaches were very important. And, you know, I think there's kind of a fallacy that says, I mean, all the coaches are good. And that is not true. But what is true is that you can learn a lot from every coach that you encounter. So there were a lot of coaches that were instrumental in my career, really teaching me, you know, in a genuine kind of way, you know, the way to play the game, you know, from the mental aspect, you know, from the physical aspect. These are the guys that kind of see you play from outside and kind of see flaws in your game and point them out to you. And it's up to you to take their constructive criticism in a way that you can apply it, you know, to say, okay, maybe I'm doing this wrong. Maybe I'll try a different way, or maybe I'll try the way that they're saying for me to try. But there's also, you know, you have to exercise your common sense as well. And there are coaches that, you know, their way that they were taught were very harsh, you know. And so they have this sort of way of teaching people by maybe perhaps putting them down or by just, you know, making fun of them or whatever the case may be. But that should never deter you from giving them an opportunity to see what can you learn from them.
Yeah.
Whether it's good or bad, you're always going to have a learning experience, you know, from a coach. And it's just a matter of taking what you can that you think is going to work for you and then just discard everything else.
Give me an example of when a coach delivered something maybe not the nicest way and how you took it. How did you handle that? Criticism at a young man, you're probably thinking, I got game, I'm, you know.
Yeah, there was this guy that I was competing with him for the center field position in Double A. This guy was the manager of the team, and he said he saw me making a play or a mistake, And that he said to all the players, that is the reason why this guy is never going to be in the big leagues.
Oh.
Yeah. So when I heard that, I was like, okay. So I learned a lot about myself because, you know, my uncle would have been, you know, try to punch him in the face. While my uncle was trying to punch him in the face, I would say, you know what? I'm going to prove him wrong. And then it was just a personal thing. I was the best worker. I was, you know, I would like stay out, you know, after hours to try to make, you know, the best of my time, working on my skill level. I just took it personal. And then about 2 years after that, I was in the big leagues. And then the guy that I was competing with, I never really heard from him anymore. And then, you know, the funny thing was that guy, the manager actually made it to the big leagues with the Cubs. And then he, you know, I remember him and I said, hey, how you doing, man? And then the one thing he said to me was like, dude, I had no doubts you were going to make it. I had no doubt in my mind that you were going to make it. I was like, yeah, right. Thank you so much. Get out of here, man. So, yeah, I mean, but, you know, there's a way of learning and a way of learning and a way to react to different things and just making sure that you're the best with the circumstances that you have in front of you. I'm making sure that you work them to make the best out of the situation.
Yeah. I mean, someone can inspire you in a positive way or in a challenging way.
Of course.
You go, yeah. I'm showing this guy.
Yeah. And it goes on and it's all part of your, you know, journey. It's all part of your, I think you are supposed to go through adversity. I think that's the only way that you can grow up. I mean, everybody can do well when things are going well. You know, it's like, it's a given. But you see the true character of a person, what does he or she does when times are not, when it's not 100%, you know, and things are bad.
Let's talk about that. I mean, in baseball, it's such an individual game in many ways when you're at bat. How did you personally get through slumps? I mean, everyone has them and they're highly public. You are out there at the plate. How did you get through slumps?
Getting through slumps is really difficult because at the time that I'm in the big leagues, I have been playing this game since I was 8 years old. So you figure you have a pretty good idea what it is to be a good hitter. But yet, you go into situations in which you kind of go 0 for 20, you know, and you can't buy a hit. You can't do this. You can't do that. And how do you get through those situations? To me, it was more like going back to the basics. And sometimes I would lose sight of what it was, my fundamentals, all my technique and everything that got me to the point. Maybe I got too distracted and said, you know what? Maybe I don't have to work as hard because I already made it. And then all of a sudden, boom, it hits you right there. Somebody that has no business striking you out, strikes you out, and he laughs at you. It's like, yeah, I got you. So you're like, no, there's no way of me, you know, letting this thing go. And I have to constantly work in my craft to make sure that that's one thing that I don't have to worry about. And then just kind of learning from every mistake that you make, you know, and just kind of, I think going to basics. For me, in baseball terms, it was trying to hit the ball up the middle every time. You know, that's the best way that, unless you had a shift on you. Now, nowadays they have all the shifts. But my thing was, you know, to see the ball, hit it where it's pitched. Don't try to hit a home run. Don't try to do too much. Just hit it with authority where it was pitched. And to me, that was the one thing that got me through slumps, which I guess is translated to get back to basics. Go back to, you know, whatever got you there in the first place and make sure that you have that under control and then, you know, see what happens. The one thing in baseball is like, it's really funny because you can have everything going for yourself. Mentally, you're ready. You're ready physically. You have nothing to worry about. And then the game comes, first at bat, the umpire calls a bad pitch on you. Ah, you're out. Strike, you know, you're out, 0 for 1. Then you hit the ball, great. Almost, but it robs it, you know. So that's 0 for 2. Then you hit a ground ball to shortstop. You run, you're out, 0 for 3. And you're feeling great. You're like, why is this happening to me? Yeah. So the game of baseball is one that teaches you how to deal with adversity. Most of the greatest hitters in the history of the game still fail 70% of the time. So I think it's really, really important to have this ability to deal with adversity and to learn from your mistakes from one at bat to the next. You have to make that adjustment. What did he throw you? What did he get you out with? Oh, a curveball. Well, next at bat, you're going to have to be looking for that curveball or that four ball in the dirt or that changeup or, you know. try to control the things that you can control. It's paramount in the game because there's a lot of things that you cannot control, and you cannot let that get you down. Because if it does, then half of your confidence is gone, and then the rest goes with it.
So just substitute some of those names in music retail, the things that you can't control. I mean, every single day, these people are going through the exact same thing. And sometimes there's seismic shifts where the rules are changing. At least in baseball, the rules stayed fairly consistent. I mean, in business, these people are dealing with things that are completely from what they maybe started the game they were playing to now, it's so different. And I think you're right. The idea of you've just got to get up and brush off and do it again.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, this whole thing about luck, it is there, I think. And I heard a coach tell me a long time ago, Wally Moon was this coach. He told me a long time ago, luck may get you there to the big leagues, or it may get you to a place that you feel like you have arrived, but luck itself is not going to keep you there. It's not going to keep you there. What's going to keep you there is your work ethic, your commitment to excellence, and you do all the things that you have done to make sure that you got in that place in the first place. If you keep doing those things and never lose sight of that, that's what's going to keep you there, not luck.
Yeah. In business, you know, the economics or the business cycle will be sometimes relentlessly sending someone signals that, hey, you know, you've got to fix this or try harder. In your case, you could be at bat and have 37,000 Boston fans at that moment unified in one thing, willing you to lose, willing you to strike out.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if in business we ever get that direct feedback. I mean, at retail, sometimes at the counter we do. But 37,000 people screaming for you to fail.
Oh, yeah.
How's that feel?
It feels great.
Not the answer I was going for.
It feels great. You know why it feels great? Because you're a player that they think that you can hurt them. If you didn't matter to them, you will hear your name mentioned, you know, in the PA system. Now hitting 51, Bernie Williams, and you'll hear crickets because they don't really care. They say, this is an out, whatever, next hitter, whatever. But if you hear people booing you hard when your name is announced, that means you mean something. That means you can hurt them and that they're paying a lot of attention to you. You can use that to your advantage. So you said, yeah, I'm here and I'm here to hurt you. So get ready. I got ready. I'm prepared. So let it rip. But it all comes down to preparation. If you prepared and you're ready to do it, then your anxiety and your nervousness turns into excitement. It's like, yeah, I'm ready to do it. You're pumped. If you're not prepared, that same anxiety could turn into a nightmare. And then you freeze yourself because you don't think that you can do it because you're in your mind, you don't think you're ready. And they can read that. They can smell that a mile away. If a guy stares you down and you're like, you seem like you're a little nervous and out there, you don't feel sure of yourself. It's like, I got him. I got him. Whatever it is, call it. I'm going to get him. So it's this psychological warfare between the hitter and the pitcher, and it's a lot with body language. You have to carry yourself like you're ready. Even if you're not, you may have to, you know, let them know, hey, I'm here to play. Bring it on. Yeah. A lot of these things, that's the way they work.
I think when you walk into a store, and we both go to music stores a lot now, you can tell instantly what that culture of that store is. Whether you feel like that, they got it, it's all down, it's gonna be, I'm so happy I'm here, or not. Or, this probably isn't happening, I'm gonna go down the street. You know? It's an interesting thing about even when you're ready or when you're not. We had done a session for some college kids once, I remember. And some of the young people, not my children included, I guess, were trying to, they need to learn adversity. They need to learn that life isn't always, oh, you get a pony, oh, yeah. And you said something about when you play so many games, and it's a long season, 160 games.
162, yeah.
You got to learn to play hurt.
Yeah.
And not let them see it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how does...
Yeah, learning to play hurt, learning to play not 100%. I would venture to bet anybody here, take a hold of all the players that are playing in the big leagues right now. I would say even now that the season hasn't even started yet, I would say 70 to 80% of those players are nagging, are nursing some nagging injury. They're not 100% there, but they learn how to play hurt with, play with pain, learning how to, put that pain aside and just kind of, do the best that you can. And there was one situation in the minor leagues that I confronted one of these coaches. He was the manager of my AAA team, and I was nursing a hamstring injury. And the guy asked me, how do you feel percentage-wise? He said, well, I think I'm about 70, 75%, something like that. And then he told me? He said, instead of saying, oh, well, just wait until you're 100%, he said, no, your 70, 75% is better than most people's 100% here. So we need you out there to do the best you can. So that got me into thinking that, you know what, these people are depending on me to play, and whether I'm hurt or not, if it's, possible that I can actually put an effort there and not hurt the team, I'm going to do it because it's beyond physical. It's more mental now. And just making sure that I pay attention to that commitment that I made and just make sure that I'm there for my teammates as well, put that best effort forward was really important and a really important part of my learning process as well.
I think in business, every one of us have to sometimes put the game face on. You might have just, had a business setback or a big sale that fell through, or in my case, got subpoenaed. I mean, just saying, there could be things that happen, but you've got to just go out.
Yeah, and sometimes, they see your name. I mean, they say, well, he might be hurt, he might not be hurt. But once they see that name in the lineup, they say, oh, he's playing. That changes the whole complexion of what they were expecting. It's like, oh, we got to get ready. This guy's playing now. So even your presence, even if you're not 100%, may mean a lot by just being there.
Yeah. I want to talk about teamwork a second, because nothing in our businesses happen. And then, I've been blessed with I'm the luckiest guy to have the staff that we get to work with, Mary and Eric. Nothing happens without the team. And a lot in baseball, I was thinking about, and I heard you tell a story once about how, you'll even sacrifice for the team. You were talking about being at bat and letting some pitches go so that your teammates get a better handle on what's being thrown, even if you're personally not going to benefit out of it, or maybe even put yourself at risk and all that. There was something I was reading about the teamwork, about how, any stories about teamwork? I was thinking about your book. There was a couple in there that were really good.
Yeah, teamwork obviously is really important. One of my managers used to tell me, we are as strong as our weakest link. So it was the responsibility of every single player in that team to be at their best. Sometimes it will fall like in the last inning, you put a bench player to run and he makes a base running mistake and we lose the game because the guy is not prepared. You have to be on 100% at all times and making sure that everybody's that way, talking about the team. Also, playing baseball, you have an opportunity to play selfishly or to pray for the team. In many instances, let's say, for instance, man on second base, no outs, and the game, it might be on the line or whatever. You as a hitter, you have to hit the ball to the right side of the field to get this guy an opportunity to come to third base. So it'd be easier for the next guy to bring him in. So that will be a team thing to do. The selfish thing to do will be to try to hit a home run, thinking, well, I'm going to bring him in anyway, so I'm just going to bring a home run, hit a home run. And in that process, you roll over and you hit a ground ball to shortstop and you get thrown out in first. So you're not even did your job. So, and you actually put the team, in a worse situation than it was before. So those are the things that, teammates look for. Is this a guy that is actually making an effort to be a team player or he's just playing for himself? As a player, you have many opportunities to turn the tide one way or the other, depending on the way that you play, if you're playing for yourself or you're playing for the team. More times than not, if you hit a home run, everything is forgotten. Oh man, that was a great play. Yeah. If you don't, then at least you have to make sure that you try to do what you were supposed to do. Right. It's not a guarantee, but at least you're trying.
Well, there's not a lot of sports that you actually use the term sacrifice.
Yeah.
That you actually would sacrifice yourself. I mean, the equivalent of, I guess I'd say, I'll I'll give up my drum solo for the bass player this time. You know, that's a real sacrifice, you know. But the idea that, you know, and you and Mr. Steinbrenner, I love the way you always called him Mr. Steinbrenner. That was one of his mandates, move the player.
Yeah.
You know.
Play as a team, play your best. I mean, he invested a lot in that team, and he expected perfection out of us, which is really, really hard to do. But you figure in the pursuit of perfection, you find excellence along the way. Yeah. So they wanted us to be excellent. I mean, they wanted us to be perfect, but we ended up trying to be, you know, the best that we could be.
Yeah. Okay, now we're going to shift into music a little bit. So I'm going to segue a little bit on one metaphor. You've used the metaphor of a great double play as being very musical in how it plays out, a trio, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't we do that one?
Well, because you know, it's just the way it looks, very artistic. I mean, back when I was playing, now the rules have changed. You're not supposed to try to take the second baseman on, you know, on and to try to put him in left field as you're running.
Kinder, gentler.
Yeah, it's a kinder, gentler era of playing the game. But yeah, you see these guys, especially the second baseman, pivot, taking that ball, throwing it out, you know, maybe just kind of sidearm, and then avoiding the guy that is basically trying to hurt them.
Yeah.
And you see all these great pictures of people like maybe just suspended in the air, just kind of like making a split, doing this, you know, this whole thing. And then the timing that you need to have to make that play, you have to sort of time yourself so you can catch the ball and touch the base around the same time and then turn, throw, and then avoid whoever is trying to kill you out there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely like playing giant
steps. Instead of like a trio of Basie, Page, and Philly Joe Jones. Because of the idea of interpreting what the next one was gonna do in real time. Okay, so now onto the music side. So there's an interesting thing you've said once on the Hill about how you met Paul Simon originally, and you've worked with him a lot, and it's been obviously an influence on you. But it has to do with also confidence, because I was thinking about confidence in obviously what you do. You have to have, you know, nerves of steel. But you told a story about how you originally met him walking into the clubhouse or into the game.
Into the stadium, so, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, this is a really cool story. I remember the players go into the parking lot, and then at the old stadium, we go across the street to go into the stadium. I always wanted to avoid that because I wanted to avoid, you know, the crazy fans, you know, with the things, you know, sign this, sign that, and you're trying to take pictures and all that. So I would go into the loading dock, which is on the opposite end of the stadium, and I would walk down, and I would go across the field and go into the dugout, and then ultimately into the clubhouse where the locker rooms were. It was one of those days. It was a day game, and it happened to be the day that they were going to honor Joe DiMaggio's memory. You know, it was his passing. And I was walking through, you know, the loading dock into left field, going across the field, when I hear this guitar playing. And I knew it wasn't a recording because the guy was stopping and starting again and stopping and, you know, getting some levels in. And I'm like, where is this guy playing? Where is he? So I look to my left, and there's this tiny guy with a little monitor wedge, just kind of doing this. And I just make a beeline, whoop, going to center field. And it's like, what is this guy doing? This is my office. It's like you go into an office and finding somebody just kind of like crossing their feet in your desk,
you know,
like
that. Your center field.
What are you doing? So as I get closer and closer, I start realizing that this is Mr. Paul Simon, sound checking for this thing that he was going to do before the game. He was going to play Mrs. Robinson. So he had this somber sort of version of it, kind of pensive, a little bit more, you know, a little bit slower. And then that struck a conversation with him. Said, "Oh man, yeah, Bernie Williams. I actually play where you're standing right now, and this is just a great honor to meet you." And then we started talking about guitars. We didn't start talking about baseball. We started talking about guitars. What are you playing? Oh, what chord is this? Oh, wow, this is great. So from that point on, we started a great relationship. He was already a great Yankees fan. So I became a Paul Simon fan. And we have worked together and sort of jam a little bit, you know, different places. You have gone through a lot of my charity events and done the same with him. And it's been awesome.
But you could have kept walking through.
I could have kept walking.
I'm not going to go see.
Yeah.
One of the questions he asked you on that day was, and this is like the last of the baseball questions in a sense, but because I think none of us will never know what that feels like to be in center field. And he asked you what it felt like to be in center field. I mean, again, can any of us imagine the pressure of being and trying to cover just in front of thousands, tens of thousands of people? What's it feel like to be in center field?
I mean, the obvious answer is it felt great. But at the same time, in hindsight, I start looking upon that. And while I was playing, I was so immersed into doing well that I did not realize the enormity of
sacred ground
of the situation. I'm like playing center field. I'm doing my best. I'm like, this is my place. But I'm not, I wasn't able to step away from that mental space and say, you are so lucky. This is such a
this
great
is where Joe DiMaggio's
place.
Office was too.
Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Mickey Rivers, you know, all the people that have played in that position. Yeah. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to be one of those, you know, carrying the legacy of that position with the team. When I was playing, I mean, it wasn't until I got older when I started realizing how fortunate I was. And every time I heard, take me out to the ballgame in the seventh inning, and I was there, I was like, oh, I'm so glad that I still have a job. Yeah. You know, I'm still working here. And it was just the best of times.
So after, you know, you started playing again, like you'd been playing the whole time, you were just talking about still bringing your guitar on the Yankees plane. But you kind of got more serious about it, and you wrote this book. We're talking about you were at school. If you haven't read this book, I feel like Johnny Carson.
You
the book
should.
Is available now, you know. But, you know, you started in some ways kind of over being a student, ultimately going to the Manhattan School of Music. I mean, what made you, having reached the pinnacle of something, realize I need to go back down the ladder again and be a student?
I think it was a combination of factors. My mother, obviously, I mean, you heard the story, you know, at the beginning of the interviews, you know, being the educator that she was always adamant about me finishing a college degree. And she didn't care how many home runs I hit. She didn't care how many World Series I've gotten into and how many, you know, MVPs I had. He said, you need your education. Even if you go to the big leagues, you're still going to have to handle money. You're still going to have to, you know, be a public speaker. You're still going to have to, you know, deal with people.
Balance your checkbook.
Balance a checkbook. Do that. But the point is that you need your education.
No one here knows how to do that either. So don't worry about it.
So she was very adamant about that. So that's one of the reasons why I did it. I mean, I started looking at that in hindsight, you know, going into a profession that is highly competitive, probably as competitive, even more than sports. I needed to know what I was getting into. And going back to college was probably the best decision that I've ever made after baseball, because of the fact that it gave me a perspective on why I'm doing what I'm doing. Why am I being a musician? It was such a humbling experience, because going into the Manhattan School of Music as a 40-some-year-old guy going into his undergrad, you get people there that are 18, 19, 20 years old. They have been playing an instrument since the time that they were born. You know, 3-4 years old, they have a violin or a piano or whatever it is. By the time they're 17, 18, they're pretty good. So they were running laps around me. And I thought I knew how to play, but nothing compared with these guys. So I really had to work. I had to work really hard. And also, the fact that I realized that I thought I was, you know, I had pretty good ideas writing music and writing my own tunes. You know, once I started going there and listening to Parker, Coltrane, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Beethoven, and what did they do with the ideas that they had? I was like, I think this is about the journey, not really about being the best. So in my mind, I was like, it was very humbling to see that all these people were here and very, very committed to doing the best that they could, you know, trying to hone their skills to a level that they could be considered masters on their instrument and in music, knowing beforehand that there would never be a Mozart or Beethoven or, you know, or all these like great iconic composers in music history. And you probably put the Beatles there too. So you're like, you know, this is not a competition. This is about enjoying the journey and making sure that with the music, that the knowledge you have in music, you can make an impact in your community in whatever capacity that is. And to me, that was an eye opener for me, you know, going into school and just That was probably the best thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah. And sometimes we all have the opportunity to actually step back and relook at life in a different way. And that's sometimes maybe when the best growth comes too. But because it opens doors that you never even knew existed. So, I mean, this book came out. Larry Morton and Hal Leonard called me and said, hey, this is a great book. You should read it. But also, you should meet this guy. And somehow all this connected with Mary at a VH1 Save the Music thing. And next thing you know, it's been 10 years you've been going to Washington with us, yeah, lobbying for music education. And it's just, again, none of that was ever preordained probably when you started thinking about your next life, your next phase of life. But let's fast forward to Bernie the Advocate on Capitol Hill in a suit and tie. Woo. We've had some interesting trips up there.
Yeah, very interesting trips. Yes.
I mean, you know, and it's cool because when you go to Capitol Hill, especially in the Senate office, the security is a little different, but you go to Capitol Hill, the security is tight, but they all know Bernie Williams. And I don't know, sometimes they know you're coming even because they bring baseballs to sign.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're like going in as a celebrity going in, you know, we may have like Tony Bennett or something, but if Bernie's there, all these security guys are like, they're either giving you grief about their team or they're total Yankees fans, you know.
But just, even the guys that said, oh man, I'm a Red Sox fan. And I was like, all right, man, nobody's perfect, you know. you're yeah, going to
and then
joking
you get pulled
with them.
Over to Capitol Hill secondary.
No. Yeah, he was great for me personally to have the opportunity to talk to lawmakers about my experience with my relationship in music and how important that was to making the person that I am today.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really envision to be a professional musician or anything of that sort, but I did start making connections in life very young, at a very young age, through music. And all the things that I've learned in baseball, you know, timing. Timing is everything in baseball. It's always in music. 100% effort, you know, that commitment to excellence, you know, that sort of learning from your mistakes and moving on and see what you can, you know, do better the next time. That all that whole thing I learned by learning guitar when I was 8 years old and going through my experience as a music student in this performing arts high school. I was able to put all of that into baseball and being a professional baseball player. And then it was awesome because then I had an opportunity to tell these lawmakers that music is not for the people that want to be professional musicians. It's for everybody. It's a great learning tool for everybody, especially for our kids, and they need it so much. And that was, you know, my purpose of being then. And I was so fortunate that I was in an opportunity that I was being heard by all these lawmakers, being an example of somebody that have gone through this process.
I mean, that's just such an example of Bernie's commitment of excellence, whether you're doing baseball or music or becoming an advocate. You are an expert now. When you go up there, you hit the spots. We were in different offices. I mean, one of my funniest remembrances of one of these serendipitous moments, you and me and Tony Bennett. Nancy Pelosi's office.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, and I'm looking around going, how does this stuff happen, by the way?
You know, I was thinking the same thing.
But it's a teamwork.
How does it happen? I feel like an episode of Quantum Leap.
But the team of, you know, boom, 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 hitting our spots, everyone making the point, and then we get on to the next one. I mean, it's a skill, like everything else. And like everyone here has their skills, they're transferable to different things.
Yeah.
You apply them to different things in your life. So I just think it's been, you know, we've had some amazing memories, and now all of a sudden, with the Turnaround Arts, with one of the programs to do with the Obama administration, you have your own school.
Yes.
One of the Turnaround Arts ambassadors,
Yeah, Tisdale School in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And I had some experiences with those kids. Had an opportunity to perform with them several times. And one of the most memorable ones was in the White House in front of Mrs. Obama. And she came into one of the rooms where we were all, you know, sort of waiting to go into the main stage to perform. And she took a picture with all of us. And these kids, it was just a collective emotional state. Everybody started realizing where they were and who were they taking the picture with. And everybody started crying, all emotional. And I started getting choked up. And it was just incredible. That experience, I know for a fact that they will never forget. And I was just really, I mean, proud of being part of that moment with them, for them. I mean, that's, to me, that was one of the perks of being able to do a thing like this. And I will never forget that moment.
Yeah. and you open those doors, and
you put yourself
in the place to have those good things happen, and good things happen. So now the music thing is, I mean, it's sort of taken off, it sounds like. I mean,
Just
see if you can give a list of just even recently who you've played on stage with.
Well, as recent as a couple of days ago, I was in Vegas actually doing this event for, it was Cleveland Medical Group, and they had this night called Keep the Memory Alive, the Power of Love concert or gala. And they were honoring Mr. Lionel Richie. I got invited to play a tune to honor, obviously, to pay a tribute to his, you know, extensive musical career. So I had an opportunity to play with him on stage and with Neo, and I played a tune by myself. A couple of weeks before that, I was playing with James Taylor. I had an opportunity to play with him at the Colbert Show prior to his stint that he did in Vegas. And before that, I mean, I had a concert in Ruth Ecker Hall in Clearwater, Florida, as a Yankee coach, went to Ruth Ecker Hall and played with my band, and a lot of my teammates were there. And now I'm doing this here, which is actually really important to me as well. And I think during the course of the year, I did a thing with Billy Crystal at the Friars Club, playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. So the music has given me the opportunity to go and play in different places that I don't think I would have the access, as much access or be as much fun as if I was just a former baseball player, just trying to kind of be nice and shake hands and take pictures.
I think this is kind of the best example of Bernie's life right now, because he's missing one within even the last 30 days, maybe in the last 3 weeks. You played a fundraiser in New York, and I happened to read the New York paper the next day, and the headline was this, the name of the gal, I can't remember what it was, but
God loves,
New York
Gaither
steals the show, and it's a picture of you with Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top.
Yes.
And you played with Hart, and it was hosted by
Martin Short
and Bill Murray. I mean, all these people playing, and the headline is you.
Yeah.
And a picture of you.
I didn't know how that happened.
I'm just saying. I mean, you didn't even bring that one up. So I'm just saying, I think you got to start looking at your schedule.
Yeah, I know. They all happen
anyway,
so fast.
Just, again, these doors are open. It's just amazing to see, okay, so finish this sentence, and then I'm going to get off and you're going to play again. Nice guys finish
first.
The sentence for me.
First, at the end of the day.
There you go.
You will have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, was it worth it? What I did, winning, was it worth it? The way that I went about winning. So you could win in paper, but you could feel really miserable about it afterwards, and that's not winning. That's not how it's supposed to be, how it's supposed to be played. So yeah, good guys that play with, courage and dignity, with passion, excitement, teamwork, there's no downfall to that. At the end of the game, at the end of the day, it's all going to come back and pay off.
It's a good life. Life well lived. Amen. Okay, you going to play a few more?
I have some TV tracks there. I'm going to play two of those tracks. I haven't played them in a while, but just give you a little sort of sample of my music. This is from my CD, Moving Forward. I think the first track is called African Blues, perhaps? Yes, that's the one, yeah. African Blues from the Moving Forward CD.
Thank you. Have time for one more, then we got to get these folks on to their next session. So, have any of you been on YouTube and seen this version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game that Bernie played just before the final teardown of the old stadium, the old Shea Stadium? If you haven't seen it, you'll get a little glimpse of it now, but I would recommend you go watch it. Could you play Take Us Out to the Ball Game? Is that possible?
That's part of my speech. I mean, that's part of the surprise thing, you know. Anyways, the tune is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but it does have a kind of lengthy introduction, so bear with me. And if you feel like singing it, you sing. I'm going to play it probably twice around, so you can sing it if you want. So here we go. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. Namm. That's Mary L. N. A. M. M.